I wasn't sure how you ran these meetings, so from my own point of view, I thought it better to do something a little bit more informal, since I knew we'd be quite a small group, rather than showing you a PowerPoint presentation and maybe leave a little bit of time for some discussion. So what I thought I'd do was first of all say just a little bit of context about why I'm in China and the kind of work that my group has been doing in China, first of all, and then say why at a more general level I think developments in biomedicine are of very great importance, why we should be studying them at the London School of Economics, which is a school of economics and political science, so why on earth at the LSE are we studying these questions of biomedicine and so on. And then maybe, since I said I was going to say a little bit about genomics, talk a bit about what's happening in genomics in particular. Is that okay? And then leave a bit of time for some discussion at the end. So in the last week or so, a couple of weeks since I knew I was coming to China, I've just kept my eyes open for things that have been occurring in the news in China that link to the kind of work that we've been doing. And three things caught my eye, all of which are very relevant. And the first of this was the first publication in Nature of the work of the Thousand Genomes Project. This is a project to do full sequencing of the DNA of 1,000 individuals, which many people think, I'll say a little bit about that later, is going to have major consequences for human health. And as it happens, one of the key partners in that 1,000 Genomes Project is Professor Yang Huangming, who is the director of the Beijing Genomics Institute, which is now based largely in Shenzhen. They are one of the most powerful gene sequencing units in the world. And as it happens, they do a lot of the gene sequencing for the genomic companies in the United States. Yang Huangming has been our partner in one piece of research, which I'll mention in a second. The second thing that I noticed was in the free newspaper that comes through my hotel door every day, the China Daily, on Sunday, it had a little section on research to develop therapies for neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, and other neurodegenerative diseases, Huntington's. And one of the pieces of research that's happening there is research in animals, in particular research in non-human primates, in monkeys. And there's quite a big development in China using monkey models to trial stem cell therapies for these neurodegenerative diseases. Obviously a huge issue for China as an aging population, which is much more likely to have high incidence of neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's in the first instance, but perhaps also the dementias. The suggestion that there is a dementia or Alzheimer's time bomb way ticking in China is, I think, one to be taken very, very seriously, and one which, if it occurs, will place a huge strain on Chinese healthcare system. In particular because of some of the consequences of the one-child policy and the migration of many people from the countryside to the city, because there are there are fewer families available to look after elderly people as they start to suffer from these neurodegenerative diseases. And this is another area that our research center has been looking at, in particular the use of clinical trials and the way in which China has become such a key area for clinical trials of the medicines, but also of other kinds of therapies. China has now overtaken India as the prime site for carrying out clinical trials for drugs. And I'm sure many of you know that the question of stem cells and stem cell therapy has been quite a controversial one in China about how this work is to be regulated. This is another area where we've been working. looking at both the policy implications, looking at the economic implications, and looking at the regulatory implications. And the third area, which was actually in the front page of the China News yesterday, is about in vitro fertilization, artificial reproductive technologies. The article in the front page of the China News, and I don't know how credible this is very concerned about illegal centres where people, which have not been licensed, where people's infertility is a very big problem, growing problem in China, where people go to pay very large amounts of money to have fertility treatment. All the fertility treatment has to be done privately. And there's a concern amongst the reputable clinics that those not so reputable clinics are both undercutting them and also basically doing therapies that have not been adequately tested. As it happens, one of our longest standing partners in China is the clinic in Changsha, run by Lu Guangxu, which is China's oldest IVF clinic. And she is one of our major partners in the work that we've been doing in China. So it's clear that there are things that are happening in China which are major public interests, which also raise some of these ethical and regulatory questions. The meeting that I was at yesterday with the Ministry of Health rose out of a 3-year project that we'd done, funded by the European Commission, looking at the regulation of biomedical research in China. In particular, in looking at Europe-China collaborations, there are many, many collaborations across the European Union with Chinese life scientists. And in Europe, and I think in China, some of these collaborations were causing some concern. One of the fears was that European scientists would come to China to do things that they were not able to do in Europe. Another concern was that the research that was done in China would not have sufficient credibility in the world outside because people felt that it had not been done to the highest standards of integrity. So we were working, this was a 21 partner project funded by the European Commission and also from the UK's Medical Research Council and the UK's Wellcome Trust, which is one of the biggest global funders of research, working to talk about how one might establish a regulatory structure to govern these kinds of collaborations to ensure that the research had credibility, the research was legitimate not only in relation to the Chinese subject but also in relation to being able to publish it in the most highly reputable peer-reviewed journals. You will all, I'm sure, know what happened in Korea with the scandal to do with Professor Huang, whose research was found to be faked, not to put too high, not to beat around the bush. And that set life sciences in Korea back at least 5 years in the global field. And I think for those of us who work with China, we feel it's very, very important not only that the research in life sciences and biomedicine should have integrity, but that it should be seen and recognized to have integrity. So yesterday we had a meeting with some of China's leading bioethicists and with the Ministry of Health to set up a standing platform to provide ethical advice and regulatory guidance for these relations.
May I ask which department?
At the Ministry of Health. It was Professor He who came to our meeting, and he is, let me just get the title right, it's medical education and research, and they're the people who are responsible for ethics and governance. Mm. Let me just make sure I read you the title correctly, because I just don't want to mislead you at all. Medical Science, Technology and Education. He's the director of that department. He's an immunologist and previously worked as an immunologist at PKU Health Sciences Centre, which is where we had the meeting. So that's just a little bit of the background of the kinds of things that we've been doing in China. I thought I'd maybe just spend 5 minutes saying why from the point of view of our research centre, the things that are happening in advanced medical research and biotechnology seem to us to be of interest. One of the issues, and this was discussed in our meeting with the Ministry of Health, and is also evident when you talk to the Ministry of Science and Technology, is that in China, the question of China becoming a big player in the global biotechnology industry is very, very much to the fore. The knowledge-based biotechnology economy is seen in China as absolutely key. Biomedical research is seen as one of many priorities, of course, but certainly one priority. And many see in biomedicine the opportunity for China to make great strides within the global economy. And this is related to one of the major changes that seems to me, and obvious to those of you who are here, to have happened in the world of medicine, which is, again, to put it very simply, medicine has become big business. There's a global biomedicine and biotechnology industry, and the capitalization of research has become absolutely crucial. So however good your science is, unless there are robust funding systems to develop and capitalize that science, it's not going to enter into the global bioeconomy. And illness, in some way, illness and cure have become absolutely central to that global bioeconomy. So that's one of the things that we think is exceptionally interesting, and it's one of the reasons why at the London School of Economics and Political Science, we think it's crucial to explore this emerging and burgeoning global bioeconomy, and the way in which it's developing, and the constraints and opportunities that there are for the different players to enter into these areas. As I say, China is crucial here, not only because China is seen as a massive market for the new drugs and therapies that are being developed, although that should not be denied. Not only the development of pharmaceuticals, but as I'm sure everybody here also knows, one of the key areas of the global medical technology industry is the area of medical devices. The medical device industry, which is everything from stents to use for your heart to hips and knees and so on, probably dwarfs the global pharmaceutical industry in terms of its size. And again, seeing an aging population in China, the opportunities, market opportunities for the development of this global medical devices industry are absolutely massive. Which means that there are huge incentives for those industries to get into China, huge incentives to develop products in China, but therefore there are also key issues about how those products do come into China, how they get licensed, and how they get regulated, and how they get marketed in China. And it's one of the paradoxes that there are pretty good mechanisms for regulating drugs in China. Again, I'm sure everybody knows here, pharmaceuticals that have been approved, licensed in Europe or in North America have to be relicensed when they come into China, so they have to go through another clinical trial regime in China. I don't think the same is true for medical devices, and it's also not true for other kinds of therapies like stem cell therapies, which are also a major issue. So here are areas where China is kind of in the global biotech economy, but exactly how it fits into that, and exactly how the massive investment that China is making in research and development in this area is going to pan out, that's something I think which is of extreme interest to us. So on the one hand, one thing is happening which is of interest to us about the scale and the scope and the intensity and the economic organization of research in biomedicine, and the way in which those market opportunities are driving the research trajectory. Not always in the interest of the public good, I would say. There's a tendency to go for high-tech, high-return kinds of medical products, possibly at the expense of some lower-tech, but maybe more effective healthcare measures, which have to do with clean air, clean water, sewage systems, and so on and so forth, which we know historically have played such a great role in tackling ill health. And the very structure of the Chinese medical system, healthcare system, perhaps the reorganization of the healthcare system is as important as any fancy medical products that can be brought to market. And I know this is another thing that is of great interest. How do you move towards an insurance-based system for medical care and healthcare in China? The event that I was at on Monday, we heard comparative talks from people working in the US about President Obama's reforms in the US to bring in an insurance-based system in the US, and Professor Chen Zhou's reforms, I can call them that, here in China, to bring in an insurance-based system in China. I have to say the system that you're introducing in China, it seems a lot more intelligible than the system that they're trying to introduce in the United States, even if it survives the midterm elections. But the Chinese, talking about the regulation of how this research work happens in China, especially, and talking about that in the context of the amount of money which is being invested in this research, does have some implications for the healthcare system. That is to say, we have seen in the research that we've done some quite bad examples of research that's been carried out in Chinese hospitals. Some very, very good examples, but some also rather bad examples. And there are some structural reasons for this, which have to do with the funding of the healthcare system, which have to do with the funding of medical professionals, which have to do with the fact that in order for those hospitals and those medical professionals to be able to have a reasonable standard of living, the financial incentives that can be provided by being involved in research are obviously quite big. And sometimes one has seen situations where those financial incentives have kind of overridden the regulatory and ethical concerns. So there's a kind of interaction between the financial capitalization of the healthcare market and the way in which this actually impacts on the ground. And the last general thing, again, which this will be no news to anyone here in this room, that's happened in medicine is the very close links between medicine and basic biological research. Which may sound entirely obvious, but up until recently, the basic biological research, recently I'm talking 50 years ago, was not necessarily seen as something that was central to the practice of medicine and the practice of the cure. And what we've seen, certainly in Europe and in America, over the last 50 years, has been the belief that if you are going to tackle the major health challenges that face you, you need first of all to understand the basic pathology of the conditions at a molecular level. And so there has been a very great deal of investment in basic biomedical research. In my country, by the Medical Research Council, by the Wellcome Trust, and so on. And the idea that if you can understand the body as a kind of machine, then you're going to know how to intervene in it, to understand illness, to understand health, illness, and cure. At the level of genomics, understanding the way in which genetics works. At the level of neurosciences, understanding the way in which the brain operates. And at the level of drugs, understanding the molecular mechanisms by which drugs work. The idea that once you have this sense of the body as a molecular machine that you can reverse engineer and you can see how the body works, then as soon as you see what's going wrong, you can target ways of intervening within it. This at least has been the dream. I've done some work with the Medical Research Council in Britain over the last few years. And the Medical Research Council in the UK is funded by the UK taxpayer through the Treasury. And the Medical Research Council has funded wonderful pieces of research, I don't know, 32 Nobel Prizes, thousands of the most highly cited papers in science and nature. And yet the view of those who are doing the funding is that all this funding hasn't translated into advances in healthcare, that there is a translation gap, a very big translation gap between what we know about the body and what we're able to do about it. Over recent years in the UK, there's been a great deal of investment in translational medicine. How can we translate from the bed to the bench and then back from the bench to the bed? This is a process which sounds very simple, but is very ill understood, about how discoveries that you find in the laboratory can actually turn into cures in the clinic. Every other morning on the radio in England, some scientist is brought on who's made some major advance, and they published a paper in Nature and Science about the genomics of a particular condition, and they explain their research, and the question that the interviewer asks is, when is this going to be in the clinic? And the answer is always 5 to 10 years, and that's not a very satisfactory answer. And I think it's fair to say that all the hope that's been invested in this great capitalization of medicine, this great advance, learning a lot more about fundamental developments in the human body, has not always translated into therapeutic products. The area that's closest to my mind, which is where I've worked, is in the area of psychiatry, where we certainly understand more about the brain and neuroscience today than we've ever understood before. There was a great belief in the 1980s that this new understanding, molecular understanding of the brain, would translate into drugs and therapies. The development, for instance, of a whole new generation of drugs to treat depression. But actually it turns out that those drugs to treat depression were not that much more effective than the old drugs that they replaced. The claim that they were smart and targeted proved to be premature, and the pipeline and development of psychiatric drugs has proved to be very clogged up. In fact, I believe that some of the big pharmaceutical manufacturers have pulled out of developing psychiatric drugs, despite the fact that it's potentially a very, very big market. So that's a general background about the research centre, about some developments in medicine. I just wanted to say a few words, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, about genomics, because this was the big hope, genetic medicine. So, I'm sure everyone here knows as much as they ever wanted to know about the Human Genome Project. China played its part in the Human Genome Project. Again, the work of the BGI was very important there in the Human Genome Project. And the gene sequence that was produced was amazing. And since then, certainly the BGI has been involved in sequencing the genomes of many, many organisms, sequencing the rice genome, a year or so ago, publishing the first gene sequence of an Asian individual, diploid sequence of an Asian individual. We seem to know a huge amount about genomics. And as everyone will be aware, at the beginning of the Human Genome Project, the belief was that the developments in understanding the human genome would lead to major advances in being able to understand the genetic basis of disease, and on that basis being able to develop targeted interventions for diseases. 20 years or so ago, one of the great enthusiasts for this human genome project and its possibility for disease, understanding and targeting disease, Leroy Hood made a prediction. He said in 20 years it will be possible to understand the genetic basis of every disease, to understand that genetic basis when a child is born, or if not before, to make predictions about that child's disease susceptibility. On the basis of those predictions, to be able to identify the problematic gene sequences that were likely to lead to future disease. On the basis of those predictions, to develop targeted drugs that would address precisely the pathologies of, generated by those disease sequences. It wasn't that disease would be wiped out, but that almost every human disease would be amenable to understanding at the genetic level and to a pharmaceutical intervention that would at least manage it, even if it didn't cure it. His dream was then for what he called personalized, predictive and preventive medicine, the famous PPP paradigm that was going to be the revolution in medicine. And I read an interview with him a few weeks ago, actually, where he said he wasn't in favour of PPP, now he was in favour of four P's, PPP, but I can't remember what the fourth P was, but he still absolutely believed in this dream of personalised, predictive and preventive medicine. A book was published recently by Francis Collins, the director of the Human Genome Project in the United States, again making these very, very strong arguments for personalized, predictive and preventive medicine, based on the idea that you would be able to find the genetic signal for common complex disorders and be able to intervene in these common complex disorders.
The first P is pathology?
Personalized, predictive and preventive. The fourth P, I think
pathology.
I thought it was powerful, but I don't know. But then I was talking to Professor Lu Guanxu yesterday, and she said now we talk about five P's.
Oh,
I don't know which the five P's are. So, I mean, obviously, part of this was pharmacogenomics. Part of this was the dream that you would find the pharmacogenomic basis. And you would tailor drugs. I don't know what you think. I would be interested in a second, as soon as I've finished my introduction, to hear what you think has happened to that promise of pharmacogenomics. I'm involved with the big UK Bioethics Council, the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, and we did a report on pharmacogenomics a few years ago when we were sceptical, when everybody else was enthusiastic. I kind of think our scepticism was better placed than other people's enthusiasm. There are a few poster children, as we would say, of pharmacogenomics, but they're not really actually pharmacogenomics. So there's Herceptin for breast cancer, but Herceptin doesn't look at the genomic basis of breast cancer. Herceptin looks at the genomic structure of the tumour and deals with the genomic structure of the tumour. So I'm quite sceptical about whether tailored drugs are going to be the way forward. Certainly individually tailored drugs. And I haven't really seen many pharmacogenomic products coming onto the market. Some people say this will change with very fast throughput gene sequencing that will enable gene sequencing to happen in your GP's clinic. And obviously the cost of gene sequencing has gone down so astronomically. But it's not clear to me that the companies, and it's not clear to me that the health services, are really wanting to go this way. Partly, I think, certainly in Europe, because of the cost that will be involved if you go to pharmacogenomic drugs. because almost all the drugs, what's happening, it seems to me, and again I'd be interested in your views on this, is that some companies are bringing to market a drug which is co-licensed with a genomic test, partly to reduce the problem of the adverse effects. So if you can screen out that group of people who are going to have the adverse effects from this drug using a genomic test, you can just give the drug to the people who are not going to have the ADRs. And I've seen some of those co-marketed in the United States, and also co-marketing the very, very expensive drugs for late stage cancers, which are so expensive that they can't be afforded on most healthcare systems. Some say, well, okay, if you market this drug with the genetic test that's going to indicate whether or not the person is likely to respond well to this test, then you will be able to actually give the drug to the person that wants it. So again, that would be one thing I'd be very interested in hearing your views about, this whole PPP paradigm, the first bit being pharmacogenomics. The second bit of the PPP paradigm being the idea of profiling, of genetic screening. This was the part of the Leroy Hood dream. Again, using the English example, the Wellcome Trust has pumped a great deal of money into genome-wide association studies to begin in the hope of finding the genomic signature of common complex disorders. And again, they have certainly not found nothing. They've certainly not found nothing. But the work that they've done and all the genetic sequences that they've looked at, if you're talking about common complex disorders, not about rare single gene disorders, seems to indicate that if you have a particular genetic signature, your likelihood of getting that particular disease, your disease risk over a lifetime, is raised by a very small amount, maybe from 1 in 1,000 to 1.5 in 1,000. These are the levels of increase of risk, in my view, that the genome-wide association studies are finding. And for an individual, that, although it may sound, oh look, your risk has gone up by 50%, but if 50% is from 1 in 1,000 to 1.5 in 1,000, it makes almost no difference to the individual, and it makes almost no difference to the treating clinician. It may give the person some anxiety, but it doesn't really have any clinical implications. This and another report which I've just done with this Nuffield Council on Bioethics has looked at the personal genomics companies, Decode Me, 23andMe, Navigenics, and so on, all of which seem to imply that these genome-wide association studies giving these risk estimates can tell you something salient about your own health. Our view, to be frank about it, is that they can't, and I think the view certainly of many of the people working in genomics that I talk to is that whole paradigm, common diseases having common genetic underpinnings, is probably misguided. And what you see in diseases that have a family history is maybe a set of rare variations handed down that family that are not shared with any other family. If you take a disease like breast cancer, where the heritability of breast cancer is very well known from family history studies, where a massive amount of genomic research has been done, something like 20% of the heritability, 20% of what we know about how that's handed down the generations, can be explained by what we know about genomics. The 80% that we know is family history cannot be explained by what we know about genomics at the moment. And that seems to me to be a fairly big indictment. Of course we know about some diseases, and this research is not helpful, but I think what it's not really telling you is either about the targets, good targets for medicine, or about how you identify people who are at risk of disease. And I think some of these claims about screening are overstated. And so this will be another thing which I'd be interested in how you think about what's happening in China. And the third and the last thing, we've gone on for too long, third and the last thing which kind of interests me is the other side of screening. And the other side of screening is the belief that if you screen, you can have a fully preventive health service. So it's personalised, it's predictive, and it's preventive, and screening is going to allow you to intervene early in a preventive fashion. This is a very controversial issue in the UK and in Europe and in the United States, which is to do with the cost-benefit analysis of mass screening programs. The most controversial issue is, of course, in screening for breast cancer. Screening asymptomatic women over the age of 45 for breast cancer. There have been some very big studies. And, well, the jury is out, but I tend to believe that the reductions in morbidity and mortality which are discovered by those screening programs are not significant. Certainly don't outweigh the costs of those programs. Many of the anomalies which they pick up, many of the things which they pick up are minor, would never develop into a tumour. But they, once you pick up an abnormality, you are pretty much medically required to intervene. And so you intervene, and the person becomes then, in their own mind or other people's minds, a person at risk of this disease. And that's not necessarily a good thing, a person who lives their life under the doctor, under constant screening and so on. We see that with breast cancer, we see it with bowel cancer, we see it with prostate cancer. Now some people say if we have good enough indicators, then these screening programs will really work. And we know we have some screening programs that do really work, childhood screening programs and so on. But it's not clear to me that the rolling out on a massive level of screening programs, as one's beginning to see, certainly in European countries, is a way to ensure prevention or to save money for health services, which is the other side of it. Obviously, better to have a preventive service than a curative service because it will save money, but it's actually doubtful as to whether or not, the economists are doubtful as to whether or not it does save money, because what it does is it identifies a lot of people who are at risk of disease, and then those people who are at risk of disease require medical treatment. Of course, that may create a market. The people who are at risk of coronary heart disease or stroke because they have high lipid levels has created a very big market for the statins. Statins are very good drugs. They don't have very many side effects, if they have any, but they're quite rare. It's difficult to know whether there will be another brand of drugs which will be so safe and effective to give to large numbers of people, even if in reality they would not in future develop a disease. So that's the other side of the screening, of the PPP. So I have to say I'm kind of sceptical of all the P's of the PPP. And that's where I'll stop really, to see what in any of this links to what's been happening in your own work.
Thank you very much, Professor. If you want, just to large discussion other than you. I can talk from the height of my ignorance if you want me, because I have no idea. I'm brand new to this industry.
Right.
I'm working for an industry for Sanofi. I really don't know what they're working on. I don't know what they have on the pipe in this field. But if you allow me, this story reminds me a little bit, of course I exaggerate the maybe you remember a few decades ago in the Soviet Union, there used to be Lenin's Brain Institute. And in this institute, people were slicing the brain of Lenin to try to find where is his genius. So, of course, I'm not doing quite a parallel, but my point is, as you say, this research lead people to think that genetics, genomics, is everything, is the key to everything, which is not necessarily the case. As you say, in some time, in some research, breast cancer or other cancers, we can see that the incidence of the, we can identify a few clues, but they're not that decisive in the genesis of the disease. So my first question would be, what is for you the proportion, if I may say so, of the genetic factor in the top etiology in the genesis of diseases, roughly speaking, and what are the part of other factors, environmental, human habits, and so on. Don't you think the genetic part looks very tiny?
The very short answer is yes. At the beginning of this human genome project, to sequence the whole human genome, it was believed that if you had all this genetic information, you would understand, if not everything, at least the major part of the disease. And the line of thinking went like this. Okay, people get diseases in all sorts of circumstances, and some people don't get diseases in those circumstances. So what accounts for the people who do get the disease as opposed to the people who don't get the disease? In the same environment, some people get the disease, some people won't get the disease. The difference is not in the environment, the difference is in the genetics. So you would identify the genetic susceptibilities for the disease, and then in certain circumstances, certain environmental circumstances, those will be triggered off into the frank disease. So here was an argument that the basic, your liability to get a disease was set at the genetic level, and you kind of inherited that, and then you could probably, if you knew enough, you could read that off at birth. And then they could say, well, you've got the liability to all these diseases, and if you're in a high-stress environment, you're going to get coronary heart disease. If you're in an environment with these kinds of pathogens, you're likely to get this kind of illness. If you're in a, if you're born in a ghetto, you're likely to get depressed. So they could, on that basis, on the genetic basis, they could say, you know, what you are likely to be liable to in certain kinds of environments. And actually, it's proved to be much, much more complicated than that in the case of the vast majority of diseases. There are some diseases, single gene diseases, which you will get pretty much whatever happens. And the most obvious disease is Huntington's disease. The genetic basis of Huntington's disease was identified in 1983. It's what's called a repeat disease. So on one particular part of one particular bit of the genome, there's a sequence of these DNA bases, C, A, and G. C, A, G, and if you have less than 24 of these repeats, C, A, G, C, A, G, C, A, G, C, A, G, on your genome, you won't get Huntington's. If you have more than 26 of these repeats, you will get it. If you're in the middle, we don't know. So the idea that you could absolutely predict with certainty. Although in fact, even in that case, which this is the absolutely clearest case of a disease, of a genetic disease, two things have happened. One is, it doesn't tell you when you're going to get the disease, how quickly the disease is going to progress, what the consequences are going to be, one thing. Second thing, because it is not 100%, because of that, because it's both a fatal diagnosis and yet something that doesn't really tell you when you're going to get the disease, something like half the people who could take the test to see if they had this genetic signal don't take the test. They prefer to live a life of ignorance, despite the fact that they could know, including some of the people who funded the research to find the genetic basis. Secondly, this gene sequence was found in 1983. Mapped, sequenced in detail in about 10 years later. So we've known for a quarter of a century. Have we got any therapy for Huntington's? No. Absolutely none. So that's a real problem for the genetic basis. Though, you know, you may know, even in these, you may know that have nothing to, but that's a very, very non-typical disease. When people started doing this genetic sequencing, they thought maybe every disease was a little bit like that. But in fact, if you're talking about a cancer, if you're talking about heart disease, if you're talking about diabetes, let alone if you're talking about any psychiatric disease, the contribution from genetics is much, much lower than that. That would be point number two. And point number three is that as people understand more about genetics, they realize that there's no automatic connection between the sequence that you would read on the genome and how this is expressed in your body. This is the area called epigenetics. I don't know if anybody knows about epigenetics. Sounds all very fancy. But epigenetics, I mean, you've got millions and millions of cells in your body. Okay, every cell has got exactly the same set of genes in it. But some cells are thin, some turn into skin cells, some turn into bone cells, some turn into blood cells, some turn into liver cells. So how come they've all got exactly the same genetic complement, but some turn one way, some turn another way? But that's because some genes get switched on and some genes don't get switched on. Okay, genes are regulated. They're not... You know, I was on a panel with Francis Collins, who's the leader of the Human Genome Project and, you know, probably the most famous genomic scientist in the world, and he came on this panel. It was a big public event, and he said the genes are like the digital instructions for making a human being. You have the digital instructions and you basically feed them into a machine and you'll make a human being. And I had to say, well, you know, far be it from me, a lowly, you know, sociologist from the London School of Economics, to say to the head of the Human Genome Project, but that is not the case. They are not the digital instructions to make a human being, because what happens is that from the very moment of conception, what happens to your genes depends on their environment. Depends on their environment in the mother's body. Depends on the amount of stress that the mother is having. Depends on the nutrients of the mother. That's for the very, very earliest moment of development of the fertilized egg. And that happens all the way through. That how your genes are expressed, how they shape themselves, happens in an intimate relationship with your environment. So this idea of a sort of simple one-way street is... And this is the problem for these common disorders. If you ask, what's the genetic complement of coronary heart disease? 30%, probably 30%. But even that doesn't kind of make sense, because it's a constant interaction. Now, it may still be that you could do a whole lot to avert coronary heart disease if you understood enough about that 30%, and you could target that 30% with your drug. But in fact, the drugs that we got for coronary heart disease work at a different level. The lipid drugs, they work by acting on a risk factor. We know that if you have high cholesterol levels, you're more likely to have coronary heart disease and you're more likely to have a stroke, although we don't really know the mechanism. But we believe that if we lower your levels of cholesterol by a drug that just works on cholesterol, it'll reduce your risk. No genetics there at all. So the relationship between knowing the origin of the disease, genetic, and having a good therapy for the disease, it's not necessarily a one-to-one relationship. I think the more we know about genetics, and the more you talk to the real people who are doing the genetic research, the more complicated it becomes, and the more one should be skeptical about the simple stories about the genetic basis of this, that, or the other disease, which you see in the papers every other day.
Thank you. 我也是抛砖引玉。 I got two questions, very simple. One is, you know, I believe you heard about Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
Yes, Stephen Miller is the used to work in the King's College academic person, and used in the UK government, used him as the focal point in terms of stem cell between UK and China. But now Stephen Miller works for GE Healthcare.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, because GE Healthcare is sort of a, you know, medical technology company. So what's the company's incentive, you know, and also the work remit about stem cell, you know, for industry? So this is my first sector. Second question. Second is about yourself. I assume you're not doing the sort of laboratory work at LSC. It's much more in ethical study, policy observation. So is that so?
Yeah. Okay, let me just deal with the second one first, because I think that's an interesting question. Why at the London School of Economics, where we don't have any labs,
mm-hmm.
we don't have a hospital,
mm-hmm.
why and how are we doing this work? And you may first of all think it's a disadvantage that we don't have our own labs. But actually I think it's a great advantage. If you're working in a place that has its own lab, and you're, I'll give you an example, or maybe no, I won't even bother to anonymize it. So Cardiff University has a group of people, they're geneticists. They've been working on the genetics of childhood disorder, controversial childhood disorder called attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Their public relations office, they published a piece of research, their public relations office put out a big press release, it was front page news. We have found the genetic basis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It was a complete misrepresentation of their results, and they hadn't found the genetic basis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But if I was at Cardiff University running my research centre, and a press was to come to me and say, oh, your researchers have just published this article on the genetic basis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, I probably wouldn't have felt very free to question that. But because we at the LSE are not linked up with our own labs and so on, we have a certain amount of independence. Our future is not at stake. But of course, it would be crazy for us not to work very closely with the basic scientists. So we work very, very closely with the basic scientists. So my colleague Sarah Franklin has also been here in China, who works a lot on stem cells. She works very closely with our King's College group, Peter Brody, Stephen Minker, who was there. Because I'm interested in psychiatry, I'm a visiting professor at the Institute of Psychiatry. So I work very closely with the group there who are working on neural stem cells. Here in China, we work very closely with a reproductive clinic in Changsha, with people doing in vitro fertilization and new reproductive technology, and also doing work on stem cells. So we work in very, very close relationship with the scientists, but also we are quite careful to guard our independence so that we can stand a certain distance from them. And I think they appreciate that. And I have a slight advantage in that sometime last century I was a biologist, so I can speak their language. And actually we have about 25 researchers in our centre, and I would say three quarters of them started off as biologists or doctors or working in pharmaceutical companies. So we know what it is we're talking about, and it's actually part of what the ethic of our centre is.
Or some centres like with Imperial.
Oh yes.
We one end.
Which I didn't mention actually, which I should mention.
Synthetic biology.
So one of the, I don't know if it's too recent to be on that thing, but one of the areas that we work in is synthetic biology. I don't know, do people know synthetic biology? These words make any sense. Synthetic biology is the either the high point or the low point, whichever way you think about it, of the engineering idea of life. So with the Human Genome Project, we learned to read the genome. So we could read out the genome of the human, of the mouse, of the monkey, of the giraffe. If you read Jurassic Park, you could read out the genome of the dinosaur. Okay, suppose you move then from reading the genome to writing the genome. What is a genome? It's got various other bits and pieces around it, but a genome is effectively four sugar molecules. C, A, G, and T in various combinations. Four sugar molecules wrapped around a certain kind of a matrix. So now there are companies, and you can once you've you've established, you know, that the genome of rice is CAGGGGGG for about 100 million things. You take your sequence, you send it off by email to one of the DNA, Blue Heron or the DNA fabrication companies, and with the dollars, of course, and 5 days later you get your DNA sequence, and then you try and put your DNA sequence into some bug to make that DNA sequence boot up the bug. Okay, so this is the engineering model of life. You want an organism that can live at 280 degrees centigrade, can eat pollutants, can grow red in the presence of pollutants and green when the water is clear. You ask us, we will find the genetic basis of something that can live at 280 degrees centigrade. We will find a switch, the genetic basis of a sensor that will sense the existence of this pollution. We will find a switch that switches on when this sensor is activated. We will have two proteins, one which glows green fluorescent protein, and one which glows red fluorescent protein. When the switch glows one way, the red will glow. When the switch glows the other way, the green will glow. Then we'll make this into a film. You'll put this film onto some kind of device. You'll put this device in your water, and it will tell you when the pathogen is there. Sounds like science fiction? Well, not quite. One of the first developments, there are few of these developments that have come to fruition, and one of the first ones was a sensor for arsenic. So the little story maybe makes sense. Many droughts in Bangladesh. One of the things that the aid companies did was that they went to drill wells. Unfortunately, they drilled the wells through arsenic-bearing rock. They didn't know they drilled the wells through arsenic-bearing rock. The water that came out of these wells had a heavy concentration of arsenic. People who drank this water got arsenic poisoning. You can have an arsenic detector. It's expensive, it's delicate, and to take it out to a well somewhere in Bangladesh, it's not going to work. So a very young group of these synthetic biologists, they created an artificial arsenic detector using these techniques that I've just mentioned. You take this, you've got it in a test tube, you take the test tube, you fill the test tube with water, you leave it for 4 hours, if it glows green, the water is clear, if it glows red, the water's got arsenic in it. Another thing, we have a big grant from the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council. Not a usual research council to fund a social science institution, but it funds our group together with a group of synthetic biologists at Imperial College. The first product, is what they call an infector detector. Don't know if you have the same problem in hospitals in China, but in hospitals in the UK, it's a big problem of MRSA. It's a multi-resistant bacterial infection that you pick up from hospital surfaces.
Superbugs.
You get this in the hospital, and once you get this in the hospital, it's very, very hard to eliminate. What's the main reason why people die in refugee camps in Africa? People who have problems with their kidneys have to have a catheter inserted into the kidney. The catheter gets an infection, the infection gets up into the kidney. Once you get the infection in the kidney, the only way you can get rid of the infection is by massive doses of antibiotics. If you don't have that, you die. If you can create a sensor that will sense whether the surface has got the MRSA bugs on it, or sense whether the catheter has got the infection going up the catheter, then you can act before the person gets the infection. Again, very simple device. So these are the kinds of synthetic biology devices.
Isn't there more simple devices to detect the catheter? Oh, cool.
So what happens is, in a busy hospital ward, the people are catheterized, you know, the nurses are going around, they don't know there's an infection there. Of Of course, you disinfect it at the beginning, but you don't know if it's got an infection later on. And the only way you know whether the person's got the infection is whether they start to get the fever, and by that time, it's too late. So these are just little examples of what of the kinds of things that you can do. And in fact, we're hoping that there's going to be a workshop here in China, because synthetic biology is just developing in China. We're hoping there's going to be a workshop in the new year, because some people say that synthetic biology is going to be as important in the 21st century as synthetic chemistry was in the 19th century. Because you'll be able to create whatever kinds of organisms you want, you'll be able to harness the power of living organisms to do the things that you want to do. Major. I don't want to lose sight. I just want to come back to your question. Why has Stephen Minger gone to GE Healthcare to look at the therapeutic potential of stem cells? I think there are two reasons. Probably there's a I know Stephen a little bit, but I'm not speaking for him, so hypothetically there might be two reasons why you would go from the academy into industry, apart from the obvious ones of being given lots and lots of money, which I'm sure don't worry for Stephen. I don't know if anyone's met Stephen Minger. He's this kind of 6'7" Californian with very, very long grey hair, ponytail, hippie Californian. He's a really nice guy. Stem cell research has had quite a hard time in the academy. Stem cell research is considered for two reasons. One is because it's very, very difficult to do. Some of the things that were claimed for stem cells, the therapies that were claimed for stem cells, have proven not to actually be true. So to do the trials to actually bring the stem cells up to the level where they can be therapeutic products is very time consuming, very expensive. And actually those of you who work for industry will know that it's very hard to bring stem cells, which are living, up to the standards of GCP so that they can be commercialized. Okay, they've got to be standardized. The same stem cell from a different batch has got to be exactly the same in terms of its properties, in the same way as you would do with a pharmaceutical. These are living organisms, they're quite living entities, I should say. They're quite difficult to do. And then there have been all sorts of problems about the sourcing of the stem cells. The first set of stem cells came from the tissue of fetal tissue. And that caused all sorts of problems, especially, as you know, in the United States. People were very wary of going into this stem cell research. And then there were some celebrated scandals of stem cells, the Hwang scandal in Korea. And that made a lot of people very uneasy. It's quite difficult to get the licenses to do the stem cell, research. Industry really wants to see if it can develop these stem cells into therapeutic products. Because if they could be developed into therapeutic products, the market would be huge. Some stem cells are in clinical use at the moment. We work with a stem cell scientist actually in Denmark, and he's using stem cells, or the person's own stem cells from cord blood or stem cells from bone marrow, for elderly people who have fractures. If you have a fracture, an elderly person, you have a fracture at one of these distant things, you lose blood supply, it's very, very hard for the bone to heal. But you can use a person's own stem cells to help heal the bone. So that's a therapeutic option which is available. But the sort of goal for these therapeutic options is to have stem cell treatment for spinal cord injuries and to have spinal cord injuries. Okay, so each of these kinds of conditions have celebrities, especially in the United States, associated with them. The celebrity associated with spinal cord injury is Superman, Christopher Reeve.
Yeah.
And at the time when the Bush government prohibited research, or tried to prohibit research on stem cells, he was a big advocate for stem cell research because of the belief that stem cells could help regenerate the nerves and the the covering tissues at the site of the break. This has never been proven in human beings, although if you go onto the website of Baker Biotechnology, Baker,
in Shenzhen,
you will see the videos of remarkable cures, apparently, of people who've been given stem cell tourists who come from the United States, who've been given infusions of stem cells and find themselves able to lift themselves up from their... That was demonstrating, Brendan. Lifting themselves up from their wheelchairs for the first time in 10 years.
Do you believe?
No. Almost all this... There's never been a clinical trial.
No.
They've never published the papers. And patients who have gone back to the United States have deteriorated quite rapidly afterwards. So at least one suggestion is that this is placebo. The person gets a lot of attention, they believe they're going to get better. Their belief can take them a long way, but the belief can't take them all the way. So that's one big, huge market. Another huge market, which I mentioned right at the beginning, is stem cells for neurodegenerative diseases. Parkinson's, a shaking disease. Again, the poster boy for Parkinson's was Michael J.
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future.
He has Parkinson's.
Yeah. He's been a real activist for the use of stem cell treatments for Parkinson. It's a very widespread disease. We have drugs that can calm it down. Shaking disease. Drugs that can calm it down. But nothing therapeutic for it. And that's very controversial because it involves putting the stem cells into the brain, which involves an operation into the brain to insert the stem cells. Again, that would be a huge market, and a huger market once you begin to get stem cells, if you could ever get stem cells to deal with brain injury, would be stroke, people with their brains damaged from stroke, or people with their brains damaged from car accidents. Again, one of your scientists in Shanghai has done some interesting work on that. Or again in China, especially for the diseases of old age, Alzheimer's. So you can understand why a commercial organization like GE Healthcare thinks there is a huge potential in the stem cell market. Maybe thinks that the research in the public sector is not really addressing some of those questions with the urgency, feels that they can do better in the private sector. So maybe that's, I don't know, I could only speculate why Stephen has gone into the commercial companies. He was here in China. You must have met him when he was in fact, my bag was from the DGI, came to this, on this inspection tour. They came and looked at all your stem cell labs and things like that. And I happened to chair the launch of this event back in London, so I got my, even though I wasn't in China, I got the bag.
Thank you.
So it seems that although we have a lot of uncertainties on all the subjects, there are wonderful markets potentially. But money is one thing, science is another thing.
I think the market, science is one thing, the market is another thing. And I know I would say this, wouldn't I, but the regulation and the ethics is a third thing.
Yes.
I mean, Baker is, forgive me for using them, but they're a very good or a very bad example. They claim to have the science, they claim to have the therapy, and they certainly have a market, because they have a steady stream of people coming, paying a large amount of money for these therapies. But it's not licensed, it's not regulated, it hasn't gone through the trials, it hasn't been published, and apart from those people who are absolutely desperate for the cure, and maybe the director of the organization, other people don't believe it. So if China, or the industry in China wants to go right back to where I started at the beginning, if those who are working on this area in China want to be players in the world market, they've got to go there with their ethics and the regulation intact, otherwise nobody is going to believe it. And every time there is a scandal in an Asian country, even if it's a long way away from China, it begins to raise people's suspicions. So that's why, I come to China a lot because I love being here and working with people and talking to people, and I think the potential in this area for marketing in China, for developments in China, is absolutely huge. But only if they do the one thing along with the other thing.
Just a quick comment. In terms of Baker, even sit in the MOH panel, setting up all the regulatory issues about stem cell. So this is really dangerous. I think next time when you meet MOH people, you should read this. By all means, from various angles, we should read this.
Yes, I mean, I was at this meeting yesterday, talking to Qi Renzong and Zhai Xiaomei and people like that, and been involved, very influential in setting up the regulations, stem cell regulations. And I think they have tried to encourage Baker into the fold. Okay? I mean, if you have something that's problematic, I guess there are two ways of dealing with it. Either you can push them far away, try and punish them or whatever, or you can say, look, come work with us, we'll work with you to help you develop their standard. Nobody knows. Perhaps they've found something wonderful. Perhaps they have. Nobody knows. But if they don't go through the proper trials, nobody will know. And my colleagues that I was with yesterday say that they have lowered the rhetoric on their websites. They're trying to temper some of those claims, and they would like to become more respectable.
Right. Because Baker now set up, get some government grant, especially in Jiangsu province, and Baker even works with the Jiangsu Provincial Department of Health to set up a stem cell bank and located in Taizhou, the Great China Medical City. So it's really...
I wouldn't want you to think that I know what's happening with Baker, or that I have even said... I'm not saying that their claims are wrong. I'm not saying that their claims are false. I'm just saying that, as far as I know, they have not gone through the kinds of randomized clinical trials that a therapy would have to go through if it was to be accepted outside China. And that for that reason, the claims that are made have limited credibility outside China.
Question is, if I may, do they really need this credibility?
Right.
Because the point for them is to make anything to tell, and for them or some other kind of companies to make noise, and the market will come.
Yeah.
Why should that credibility? You don't need the outside world credibility. Because the market, the consumer here is not so mature.
Mature, yeah.
And they will make maybe a lot of profit, with which they will make serious things maybe later, but from the first step. Maybe I'm not sure if there is any really efficient incentive.
Is there an incentive to be ethical? Is there an incentive to be honest?
In China.
Yes. There's a very big incentive, if I may say.
The other thing which I would want to say is that there's a lot of absolutely top-class, fantastic work happening in China. Fantastic research, world-class research, as good as anywhere in the world. And I think one of the problems, and let's leave Baker to one side for a moment, because I don't want this to be a discussion about it, but one of the problems is that if there is a feeling that the research, the technological developments that are occurring in a country are suspect, then in a sense the suspicion spreads to others. And it's in nobody's interest. It's absolutely not in the interest of the people who are doing really top quality work on stem cells. It's not in their interest for others to feel that their work is in some way less
credible because it's happening in China rather than happening elsewhere. This certainly happened in South Korea with what happened in the big problem there. In this BioNet project, one of the people who attended many of the meetings, we had a lot of workshops and conferences in China, and one of the people who attended was actually from Novartis, Detlef Giese from Novartis, who came to a lot of our meetings and to our final conference. And he pointed out something which I think is important. It's, you may or may not be aware, but some people are rather suspicious and sometimes about pharmaceutical companies and their motives. But Detlef Giese said, look, actually what we're trying to do in China is to make sure that the work that is done in China, he's talking about clinical trials for drugs in China, that the clinical trials that are done in China have as high a level of integrity, if not higher, than anywhere else in the world. Because it's not in our interest, in Novartis' interest, to be basing themselves on trials where they can't trust the robustness of the data. And he said, and the examples he gave I think were good ones to us, that Novartis has played a big role in making sure about how the clinical trial is set up, about how the randomization is done, about how the research results are reported, and so on, so that people don't feel there's an incentive always to say that the trial drug is a good drug. Sometimes trial drugs are not good drugs, and it's important to know that the trial drug is not a good drug, not always to feel that, you know, to satisfy whoever is paying for the trial, you've got to. So does Sanofi do drug trials here in China?
I think so, yes. And I was suddenly thinking that we were just buying Genzyme, just for Genzyme, so show that maybe we have also some interest in this.
Genzyme is really interesting.
We just bought it a few days ago.
Oh, okay. I mean,
it's, yes, so we need a final authorization or something, but it's...
Genzyme has a very interesting business model. Because Genzyme produces very expensive drugs for rare enzymatic deficiency disorders. These are very, very expensive drugs. Usually orphan drugs, that is to say there's a small population of people, pretty small population of people worldwide who have these disorders. And Genzyme specializes in making a market out of this small population, which would normally not be seen as a viable market. And they do this in a number of ways. First of all, this is kind of interesting, they work very closely with patients' organizations. So they get together the organization of the patients and the families of the patients who have these rare disorders, and they act, especially in the United States, as very powerful lobby groups. And then they say to the health providers, the insurance companies and so on, look, our drug, it may cost $250,000 a year, but that's the price of these people's life, and the company and the patient's organization lobbies very powerfully for these drugs to be made available to them. And they have a kind of corporate ethic, an interesting corporate ethic of working very, very closely with these patient organizations. So you can make them, that's a way of making a market out of an area where people never thought that you would be able to make a market. Of course, it's bankrupting for a public healthcare system like we have in the UK, where we don't provide many of these drugs because they're just so expensive we couldn't pay for them. No, I didn't know Sanofi. I knew a little bit about the merger between Sanofi and Aventis, because Sanofi had that wonderful weight loss drug.
But it failed.
It failed.
And as they always do.
What earth was it called? But this was the wonderful weight loss drug. That had gone through trials. And as I understood, Sanofi went into a partnership with Aventis because they wanted a really big. Because Sanofi was quite small. And they wanted a really big player so they'd be able to sell this weight loss drug, and then it failed in its phase four or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to remember. It was began with an A, a Pierre or a Google it.
Yeah. I obviously didn't take it.
So after the merge, were you bringing the second giant or third giant?
The third giant.
Yeah. So, I don't know how much time you've got, but I wanted to see whether these ideas about genetic medicine, about personalized medicine, about pharmacogenetics in particular, whether those were ideas that you felt had a business future in drug development. In China, is that?
If I may, how about herbal medicine in terms of drug discovery? Because I learned the student used to propose a proposal to welcome trust about how the stem cell will be in the interaction between stem cell and also TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. So are you aware? Because in China you can't ignore TCM.
Yeah. Because some people say TCM is the ultimate personalized medicine. Because every individual is an individual case. And there's been some debate about whether you can ever take traditional Chinese medicines through a clinical trial.
Mm-hmm.
Since the traditional Chinese medicine is made differently for each person, the dosage is differently for each person, how could you make a double-blind trial? Because the prescribing person has to know who he's prescribing and what he's prescribing and so on. So when I was with another group, so many groups, I was with another group that came to look at, in this case, a China-UK research collaboration, a so-called CURE group, which was set up by the Medical Research Council. And we had a number of things that we were looking at, one was stem cells, etc., etc., and one was TCM, so we did have quite a lot of discussion about this. Germany actually has been very active in taking traditional medicines through the clinical trial process. For instance, the so-called Nature's Prozac, St. John's Wort. I think the country which has done the most clinical trials on St. John's Wort has been Germany. And what they found, and in fact this is what I found talking to most practitioners of TCM, because when you try to do a clinical trial with TCM, what tends to happen is that you try to look for the active ingredients. Okay, so what are the active ingredients in what proportion that you have? And then you try and take out each of the active ingredients and you trial each of the active ingredients. And it turns out that each of the active ingredients is not so active on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Each of the active ingredients depends upon the co-presence of all the other active ingredients. And as they say somewhere, nature is the best pharmacist. Nature has produced these in these ways, and it's actually very, very difficult to isolate the active ingredients and put them into
you can isolate them collectively. It was set from combinations.
The very first time, actually, very, very first time I was in China, I was at Fudan, and I was naive. I didn't know anything about anything, but I was seeing people. I think they got me to see people more or less blind, but I went to see some people who were doing this work on TCM, and I said exactly like that, well, why can't you just, you isolate this and you isolate that and you isolate that, and you can test 100,000 different combinations and you see which combination works. And the researcher that I was talking to said, well, actually in the end we decided it was not worth the trouble. Why not just give people the herb?
Why not just give people what?
Give people the herb.
The medicine.
Why not?
Yes.
Try and isolate all the active
yes.
ingredients, then work out how many and which kind of things? Why not just give people the herb?
And see the results.
Yes. Well, no, just give them the leaf. Give them the leaf. Give them the bark. Give them whatever. Why go to the business of isolating them? Of course, they're very good reasons, because then you can pattern the combination, etc., etc.
Well, it comes back to your question. You said, why should they bother going through a whole process?
Yes.
When you said when people believe or have their own
The other area where, again, I had the privilege of meeting an academician here in Beijing at the Institute of Neuroscience,
He's worked for 40 years on the neuroscientific basis of acupuncture. Professor Han. And he was a very firm believer that acupuncture had a sound neuroscientific basis. It had nothing to do with the eight meridians and all those kinds of things. But it did have to do with the fact that if you take some of these acupuncture points, like this point in particular, and you stimulate this point with the needle to a certain frequency, then this will produce a backflow up the efferent nerves, and it will produce endorphins in the brain, a certain set of endorphins, pain relieving endorphins. And if you stimulated it at another frequency, you produce a different set of pain releasing endorphins. And he'd actually produced a machine about the size of Brendan's mobile phone with a couple of clippers here that actually produced these sorts of pulses and produced anesthesia, assisted people with chronic back pain, assisted people with chronic insomnia. So that's a really interesting example of a traditional Chinese cure, which has been demonstrated to have a very, very clear, understandable pathway.
I'm not quite convinced with the machine yet.
Have you seen his machine?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I tried it.
Oh, you tried it?
Yeah.
Did you feel any effects?
I certainly felt something. But it might have been the placebo effect. I'm very, very, very suggestible. Although he said it's interesting because we've got 70% responders and 30% non-responders. So 30% do not respond and 70% do respond, which seems to indicate that either 70% are very susceptible to the placebo effect or that there's some kind of basis to it.
Actually, this is a new business trend because in China every year there are so many medical devices show exhibition. And this year, from last October in Xinjiang, it's first time, they have a TCM zone, TCM devices zone, to showcase this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
This is the very first time.
The problem is, if I may, I'm sorry to say this before my Chinese friends, but since I've been involved in TCM from very far away, I used to be an interpreter, been conference interpreter, I've been working for a lot of medical organizations, including UNESCO, and so on. And the first day I saw, it was the second World Acupuncture Summit. I was terrified, because all what I heard, frankly speaking, was all jokes. The so-called clinical trials were just funny things. The picture they gave, where they showed, was,
modified,
but it was so obvious. I told them you can make things a little bit beautiful, but please, come on, make it. And from this day, I just saw that kind of things. I've never seen someone who is really, I mean, I can't say so. I haven't, the people I suspect to be serious are really deluded in a lot of poetry, a lot of funny things. So it's, TCM is, for me, a final first a matter of confidence, of ethics.
The evil is not TCM. The evil is the people who are handling TCM now.
Yes.
Doctors,
policymakers. Yes. Especially abroad.
Especially
out of China.
Yeah.
You can hear through the end.
Yeah. They're not real TCM doctors. They're just a practitioner sort of. And then they are deteriorating the reputation.
The image.
Yeah.
Well, that's
a huge problem.
On any ethical issue.
Yeah. I mean, so there is an absolutely massive market for anything that purports to be a cure for anything. And the internet, of course, has become a huge, huge marketplace for these kinds of things. It's anything, it's TCM, it's Brendan has a brain stimulating device on his on his mobile phone, a brain gym. It's working?
It's working great.
Tomorrow it would be better, but it's working.
It's to resonate on sound, to stimulates different parts of the brain. I don't know. But yeah.
So anything that sounds at all, these days if you attach the word neuro to anything, neuro drink, neuro food, neuro bar, everybody's going to buy it, neuro whatever, neuro phone. So there's a massive, massive market for this. And of course people have always spent their money on nonsense cures and diet things and whatever, so this is nothing particularly new about this, apart from the fact that it is becoming, because of the intense sort of capitalization of the conventional healthcare industry, is also a sort of side effect of the intense capitalization of the alternative healthcare industry.
Are you in touch with Kew Gardens, Professor Simmons?
I'm not professionally, no. I walked there.
Kew Gardens, you know, they have a very big, you know, collection.
I know, I've seen it.
About TCM, you know, in Chinese pharmacopoeia, there are 575 Chinese herbs recorded in Chinese pharmacopoeia. 中国药典里收集了575种中国药, and they have collected 80% of such samples. Not just from, you know, superficial, but they collect it from the mountain, from the real 道地药材. So it's really huge, and also they do generic study and they claim IP.
Well, I think that's obviously the thing that you need to do in order to generate that industry, is to be able to demonstrate the efficacy of your product enough to be able to claim IP, and that's the standardization that's necessary to claim IP. And I would just say, I think I absolutely agree with you, there's a huge amount of hocus-pocus around. But one shouldn't necessarily throw away thousands of years of research, and some of it's been quite systematic research, on what different kinds of herbs can do. And let me just give you one example, which sort of links back to the synthetic biology. What's the best treatment for malaria? It's artemisinin. Artemisinin is wormwood. Wormwood is, and in fact, I think wormwood as a treatment for malaria was discovered in China. So the active ingredient in the wormwood tree is artemisinin. There's a world shortage of artemisinin, and people develop resistance after a while to artemisinin. Jay Keesling, who's one of the four or five really big workers in synthetic biology, working in Berkeley, California, has developed a method for synthetic artemisinin. He can make artemisinin synthetically. He can collect together the various bases, DNA bases. He's done years of work on this, hundreds of thousands of person hours gone into this, and he can produce artemisinin now in a vat. And then he can show that, and he works with, I think they're called One World Health, which is a medical charity, working to distribute this synthetically produced artemisinin. And it has one advantage in that once you know how to produce it synthetically, you can modify it slightly if people begin to develop resistance to it. And so you can in some way or other reduce the problem of resistance. So here's a real example of something, you know, a traditional medicine. Absolutely works. There is an active ingredient in wormwood. It's artemisinin. It can be produced. It can be tested. It can be reproduced.
This is. Of course, I do not intend to throw away to the garbage 5 to 7 years of generation. But what you described for malaria, the question is why this has not been done for many other diseases or for many other active principles of many other plants. I know, for instance, there is a plant, I forgot the name, who is very extremely helpful in blood cancers. This is quite it's quite obvious, quite clear. So in some cases, the ingredients come from China, but very often the is not very often made by Chinese themselves, which is a pity, because they have all the ingredients, they have a lot of experience, but it seemed that for one or other reason, I don't know, the
studies are not properly conducted with proper conclusions or just
very good point. Very
so
good
I think
point.
The answer is you got the answer is there was an explosion. But I think that one thing to this in all sorts of words, I think the Artemisinin and the active principle was discovered in China. Of course, it wasn't patented, didn't give anyone any intellectual property, as I understand it. And the people who did the synthetic work to create it, I mean, they weren't funded by a pharmaceutical company, as I understand it. I think one of the worries which one's seen elsewhere, and I'm not a big gung-ho critic of biopiracy and so on, but unless there are financial incentives for the pharmaceutical companies to do this, if people can claim, well, we already knew about this herb, we had prior art in this herb, so actually you can't have IP in this herb because we have prior art, and so therefore there's no money to be made out of it, then there's not going to be a great incentive for anybody to, for any commercial company to do it, unless we can think of another way around of doing it. One of the other really interesting things about synthetic biology is that the two different models of IP involved. Craig Venter, the big capitalist who did the, great inventor who did the commercial side of the Human Genome Project, has developed an artificial organism, synthetically produced organism, and he's taken out dozens of patents on the processes to produce this organism. Whereas on the other hand, there are another group of people, the Chinese are involved with this other group of people, who are trying to develop an open source principle for synthetic biology. Open source, the idea that the basic building blocks that you produce out of synthetic biology, the switches, the stuff that grows green, the sensors and things like that, they are all placed in the public domain, and they're open source. What you can get patents on is when you assemble those together into a device that does something, but you leave all the basic elements in open source. And this is a kind of interesting model which the people we work with at Imperial have kind of signed up to. We had a big workshop on that a few weeks ago, trying to create these open source models.
The Qinghao was developed in 1960s. At that time, you know, the healthcare system was still, you know, every person was, you know, quite committed to the work because it's for the country, for the people, for the party. But now the healthcare system changed after 1978 because, you know, the incentive is much profit driven. So people, no incentive. It's really for publishing just paper, get the Zhicheng promoted, and then that's fine. So I think it's the healthcare system behind. So people, no incentive to do the real innovation, R&D in.
But maybe people, there's not enough incentive in China, but I guess a lot of pharmaceutical companies, I mean, so many congresses, so many senators, if someone is a Chinese researcher, finds something that might lead to something, I'm sure that a lot of pharmaceutical companies would be interested in this and will give him the means to show if it works or not, what can we.
Well, you'd especially think so, since the pharmaceutical companies, since the drug pipeline is not in such a great state at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and not so many drugs coming down the pipeline, so you would have thought that demonstrated herbs or whatever that had seemed to have some active ingredients in them would have provided a great opportunity. I don't know enough about how the pharma companies.
No. Is that what your companies love to do? Do you go around looking for these scientists, or do you just
I guess so. I mean, if I were my company, that's what I would do.
that's clearly what you do. I mean, there are definitely these people at Fudan and others, I'm sure elsewhere, loads of places who are working on these kinds of models. As I say, not with a huge amount of success, but they don't seem to be working with the big pharmaceutical companies. They don't seem to be working with indigenous pharmaceutical companies in China. They don't seem to have too much of an interest in that, since presumably there's a market for the herbal products anyhow in China.
There are, you know, at least for the UK, I'm aware there are a couple of such, you know, small SME drug discovery companies. They're working on herbal medicine, not just limited to PCM, but also Indian medicine, etc. And then they expect when the product is half done, then they sell it to the farmer, big farmer. So normally it's like this.
Yeah.
But for Unilever, they even set up R&D center in Shanghai and study on TCM. Unilever.
I'd like to hear more about that. And we'll find out about that.
Is that all the questions?
Do you have any
questions? No? Okay. Okay, just one other thing. The next working group meeting for the pharma group will be